World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
Prime Minister Churchill has returned to Quebec after a preliminary meeting with President Roosevelt here in the United States. The full-dress war conference will take place in Canada probably early this week. On the battlefronts, American troops have advanced 14 miles eastward in Sicily with enemy rear guards in retreat toward Messina. The RAF has bombed Milan and Berlin again while American planes hit German airfields in France. In Russia, the Germans have moved up reinforcements, but the Red Army continues its advance all along the line. And now for more news, Admiral Radio takes you direct to CBS Algiers. Farnsworth Fowle reporting.
No fresh news has come in during the day to change this morning's picture, which had the American 7th Army at Oliveri on the north coast of Sicily and the British 8th Army at Fiumefreddo on the east coast. Quentin Reynolds of Colliers is just back from there from 3 weeks in Sicily. We'd like to hear how it looked to you, Quint.
Back in 1860, Garibaldi landed in Marsala on the eastern coast of Sicily. He was greeted with cries of joy from the people of the island. He had come, he said, to liberate Sicily, and his campaign was quite successful. Now, 83 years later, the armies of Britain, America, and Canada have again liberated Sicily. When we entered Sicily, we knew who our enemies were. We knew that the crack Hermann Goering division was there. We knew that the magnificent 29th Panzer Division, composed of troops which had fought in Russia and in Africa, was firmly entrenched in the hills of Sicily. We knew our enemies, but we didn't know that we would also find friends. The reception given us by the civilian population of Sicily was unexpected, and of course, very welcome. Only the Germans, the fleas, and the flies opposed us. These were formidable enemies, for the Germans had orders to fight until they died. They did. And the fleas and the flies, without any orders from either the Fuhrer or Il Duce, fought our Allied troops 24 hours a day. But the civilians greeted our men just as they greeted Garibaldi 83 years ago. This was true even in cities which our airmen had bombed heavily, cities like Palermo, or that same Marsala where Garibaldi landed once upon a time. It puzzled you until you talked to the people, and then you realized that for 24 years, these people of Sicily had been suffering badly under the yoke of Italian fascism, and that they themselves had never been fascists. They had been forced to accept the responsibility of being citizens of Rome without ever having been granted the privileges or benefits of such citizenship. Rome always appointed the governors of the 9 provinces of Sicily. These governors received very nominal salaries, but they were permitted to feather their own nests, and they did a fine job of feathering. They sold all local offices to the highest bidders, and they levied taxes on anything in sight. Sicily was always the stepchild of Rome. When war came, Sicily's male population was drafted against its will. During the past few weeks, I have been all over Sicily, and never once did I ever see an unfriendly act or even an unfriendly glance directed toward our troops by anyone except the Germans, the fleas, and the flies. And now that we quite definitely have the Germans on the run, it won't be long before we have exterminated the rest of the vermin who still infest the island. Many of you listening tonight have friends and relatives in the 7th Army now in Sicily. I have seen them fight and been with them. And I can only say that it is a very great privilege to have been associated with these fighting men of ours, even in the minor capacity of a war correspondent. I return you now to New York.
More news in just a moment. But first, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Next time you visit your neighborhood movie and see a newsreel, watch for scenes picturing big guns of the United States artillery. Note the tremendous power developed by these guns as shattering explosions fling projectiles toward targets velocities of almost a mile a second. Note also the tremendous power of the recoil, the kick, enough to smash through an armored tank if it stood in the way. Here, in the shattering explosion and recoil, is proof of Admiral superiority. For only inches away from the recoiling breech is radio equipment built by Admiral. Tough radio equipment, which stands beside this bucking giant, is enveloped by acrid fumes of gunpowder, seared by heat, yet gets the message through to the gun crew with the same efficiency it would have while resting on a table in an air-conditioned room. The new skills, the new techniques and production methods, the research necessary to turn out tough Admiral-built radios for war will be adapted to peacetime production, to the building of Admiral radios for the American home after the war. They guarantee the post-war Admiral will be a step ahead, America's smart set, during the coming age of electronics. Now here once again for Admiral Radio is Doug Edwards.
Columbia's traveling correspondent Don Pryor has reached the Rocky Mountain states on his tour of the nation. For his account of what he has seen there of America at war, Admiral Radio takes you to Salt Lake City, Don Pryor reporting.
This is a hard country. It's made of rock and sand, violent rock that rises up to 13,000 feet, and now and then over the geologic years crashes and booms and shakes the earth. Yet it's a beautiful country. The Mormons call it the New Zion. The Mormons fit this country. They've been strong and steadfast. Out of this rock and sand, they have created a civilization. And their tools have been nothing but faith and courage. But it's a limited civilization, agriculture and mining and business. They've never made things here as they have in the East. They've taken copper from the mountains and smelted it and shipped it east. And the East has fabricated it and shipped it back to the West again. And so with many things. But the war is changing this. And that is the big news in the West today. 40 miles south of here, the United States Steel Corporation is building a miniature Pittsburgh, a big steel mill for the government. It represents the largest single appropriation for defense plant construction in the war, $180 million. Compared with Gary, Indiana, that's just a drop in the bucket. But out here in the West, it means a new life, a new trend, a new promise. While the war lasts, this steel will be used for ships. But the people here are looking beyond that, to the day when steel will be needed for the purposes of peace, all over a peaceful Pacific. They tell me that there's enough iron in the mountains here to last at least 50 years, and coal to spare, not to mention a dozen other minerals. The West is confident of the future and of its place in the future. But what of the war? To tell the truth, the war seems far away and very unreal. It's not that people here are unconcerned about it. Many have sons or brothers in the services overseas, and they know. But there is a difference. There's no dim out. Gas rationing is extremely generous. You see men and materials on the move, but you don't see harbors filled with ships and ships filled with men and guns sailing off in the night. All that makes a difference. But beyond that, these people are just about the same as other Americans. They buy just as many war bonds. Their production record is just as good. It probably isn't the fault of the people that the war is, in fact, a very good thing financially for most of them, or at least for the present. But money in the pocket does contribute to a sense of well-being. Nearly everybody is better off now than he was before the war, and nearly everybody likes it that way. There are some complaints, especially through the Midwest farming states. I talk to farmers in Illinois, Kansas, and Nebraska. There may be some who feel differently about it, but the ones I saw hated the OPA and all its works. Grain prices have been allowed to rise. Not high enough to suit the grain raisers, but much too high to satisfy the cattlemen, who are caught in the middle between high costs and low prices. Farmers are also hopping mad about the War Manpower Commission, which has allowed their boys to be drafted and their farmhands to follow the lure of high wages in defense plants. They are so mad about it, they are about to explode. And just now they are busy telling it to their congressmen. Listen for the noise when Congress reconvenes next month. This is Don Pryor in Salt Lake City, returning you to CBS in New York and Doug Edwards.
Allied bombers have again carried the war to both ends of the Axis. For a report on this phase of the news and other developments in Britain, Admiral Radio takes you to London. Larry Le Sœur reporting.
London does not yet recognize Rome as an open city, and Rome Radio has agreed that it takes both sides to declare a city open. It's understood here that President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill will soon decide what requirements will be demanded and what guarantees will be necessary before the Allies give the nod. Their decision will have great bearing on future history, for no city before has ever been declared open and undefended unless it was almost under the guns of an invader. Air bombing alone prompted this unprecedented decision by the Italians. And since Germany might conceivably declare Berlin an open city, too, if she thought she could get away with it, the Allied command is apparently in no hurry to set up history-making precedents until we see just how we can take advantage of an undefended Rome. If the Badoglio government agrees to accept our conditions, some quarters in London believe that it might be possible for our troops to make a parachute and airborne landing and occupy the Italian capital forthwith. However, it's still a question here whether the Germans would agree to the Badoglio government accepting our terms. There have been unconfirmed rumors reaching London that Rome is already garrisoned by a German division. London itself is enjoying its usual quiet Sunday. Piccadilly and Leicester Square are crowded with American doughboys out sightseeing or taking their girls to the movies. The varicolored uniforms of many nations pepper the long line in front of that old favorite, Gone with the Wind, now in its fourth year. I return you now to CBS in New York.
Here in our New York studios to discuss the German evacuation of Sicily is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The German position on the northeast peninsula of Sicily seems to be disintegrating. It's not hard to understand why. The Germans are reported withdrawing in considerable numbers across the Strait of Messina to the Italian mainland under the protection of very powerful anti-aircraft concentrations on both sides of the strait. Thus, the fighting power of the rear guards, left to contest the twin advance of the British along the east coastal road and the Americans on the north coast, must be rapidly dwindling. The minds of the officers and men of these forces left behind must be turning more and more to saving themselves by getting to Messina while the escape ferries are still operating. As the Allied forces approach Messina, the peninsula narrows to a point. On both sides of this diminishing triangle, Allied naval forces are operating. The narrower the triangle gets, the more of its area comes within the reach of effective naval gunfire. And as to Messina itself, as the two forces converge on that city, each is likely to cut off the retreat of the German rear guard, defending against the other. In the center, between the coastal roads, resistance apparently collapsed with the fall of Rondazzo, which means that there's now no direct communication between the two parts of the German rearguard, except by way of Messina itself. The chances appear good for the capture of a considerable part of the German force on the Sicilian side of the strait, together with a good deal of the anti-aircraft material. While much of the anti-aircraft power may be German, which is suggested by the efficiency with which it is working, there are also suggestions that some of it may be Italian. These suggestions arise from the very low rate of loss sustained by recent Allied bombing raids on northern Italy. If the Germans have indeed stripped such great Italian cities as Milan and Turin of their defenses for the purpose of protecting the evacuation of the German troops from Sicily, this will hardly be a contribution to good feeling between the Italians and Germans in the crucial hours to come. Meanwhile, the last scene of the last act seems drawing toward its final curtain in Sicily, only 5 weeks after the first landings on that island were effected by the American and British forces under General Eisenhower's command.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. The eyes of the United Nations and the Axis, too, are on Quebec, where President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill will confer this week. Admiral Radio now takes you to Quebec. John Fisher of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reporting.
Quebec is famous for many things. One of them is the huge green-turreted Chateau Frontenac Hotel, which sits on the Rock of Quebec high above the St. Lawrence River. In the 670 rooms of this mammoth chateau is more braid, brass, and military brains than has ever been assembled before under one roof. Staff talks have been going on for nearly a week. What has been said and done may affect the lives of millions of fighting men. But that's inside the chateau. Outside, we don't know the score. We can only guess. And Quebec is full of correspondents who spend most of their time speculating. The admirals, generals, and air marshals leave the outside context to the big chiefs, Roosevelt, Churchill, and King. So far, they haven't been here, with the exception of Mr. King, the host. But a few hours ago, Prime Minister Churchill arrived at Quebec, direct from the United States. He gave the usual victory salute, but I noticed he was wearing a victory smile. He looked very happy. And this is merely a little gossip piece, but Mrs. Churchill wasn't there when the train arrived. She and Prime Minister King dashed up several minutes late, looking very embarrassed at holding up the ceremony. Mr. Churchill chided them, told correspondents he found the weather agreeable in the United States, and then dashed off. Daughter Mary was with him, dressed in her army uniform. But we expect tomorrow or next day, the public will be let in on the secret of what this Quebec conference is going to deal with. President Roosevelt is due shortly. A lot of people thought he was here the other day because of a little black dog that looked like Fala. He insisted on sitting in the center of the hotel lobby, and nearly everyone paid homage to him. They thought it was Fala, but it turned out to be the manager's dog. This is John Fisher of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation returning you to New York and Doug Edwards.
For news of the war against the Japanese, Admiral Radio takes you after a brief pause across the Pacific to CBS Honolulu. Webley Edwards reporting.
The war in the Pacific may not seem so spectacular as the roaring news of Europe this weekend. Be assured it continues as relentlessly as ever. Day in, day out, there's no tougher fighting in the world than out here where this war started for this nation and where most observers believe it finally will end. Along the present front are no vast cities like Rome and Hamburg and Berlin to be bombed, no great industrial centers to be crippled, no Odell to smash, no Kharkov to be encircled. The objectives between us and the road to Tokyo have names like Salamawa, Bairoko, Wewak, Rabaul, and Kahili, places you never heard of, until one day they became key points in a tremendous conflict. The approach to each is from the sea. This, thus, is the world's great naval battleground, a constant jockeying of ships and task forces and patrols to attack, defend, to maintain pressure, and to carry on the vital service of supply. The precious airfields on the Pacific Islands, those the Jap still holds and those we have wrested from him, are important because they are bases for planes that are a threat to naval forces. They cannot be bypassed. They must be captured or neutralized. Whether we strike from the southwest or through the East Indies or from the north, the conquest of Japan will be through naval surface and air support. And that is why most men I have talked with out here are convinced that somehow, somewhere, the great sea battle of all time may be fought between the United States and the Japanese. Destruction or even serious crippling of the Jap Navy would leave the Jap sprawling empire in a serious predicament for supplies, both for their troops and for the replenishment of their munitions and aircraft. Admiral Nimitz has said, "We have enough new power in the Pacific to retain the initiative." I believe every man in the Pacific fleet is convinced that this war could be speeded toward its end by a great naval battle in the Pacific. The fleet is eager for it. The Japanese may not be so eager. The big scrap will be a vast operation with battleships, aircraft carriers, great numbers of airplanes, and attending cruisers, destroyers, and submarines over a wide battle area covering thousands of miles. Meanwhile, the war of attrition continues, the softening up of Jap bases and airdromes by our superior air strength and the hard fighting through the jungle by our ground forces. The news may not be as spectacular from the Pacific today as it is from Europe, but be assured that America's meanest fight is going on out here. This is Webley Edwards in Honolulu. I return you to New York.
For the Washington view of this week's Roosevelt Churchill talks and for other news here at home, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Washington, Lee White reporting.
You've already heard from Quebec about Mr. Churchill's preliminary conference with Mr. Roosevelt somewhere in the United States. There isn't much to add from Washington except to say that now Anthony Eden is to take part in the conference, it's assumed that Cordell Hull will accompany the president on his journey to Quebec. When that will be, however, is still being kept a secret. At last reports, Mr. Hull was still in Washington. Yesterday, he conferred with Norman Armour, who's been recalled from his post as ambassador to Argentina. In diplomatic circles here, it's not expected that Mr. Armour will return to Buenos Aires, if at all, until the Ramirez government gives up its current dalliance with fascism and decides to live up to its promises, continually unfulfilled, of cooperating with the United Nations. What Mr. Armour's new job will be has yet to be announced. That he will succeed Sumner Wells as Secretary of State, however, as Undersecretary of State, however, has been officially denied. The War Manpower Commission last night revealed the full details of its new policy of work or fight. Under the new system, no eligible father will be excused from his obligation to contribute toward winning the war. But if he doesn't want to be drafted, all he has to do is to take an essential job in war industry, and he'll be indefinitely deferred. The Manpower Commission has published a list of 149 critical occupations where workers are badly needed. Anybody who enters such an occupation between now and October 1st will be excused from military service. If he doesn't, however, and his present occupation is regarded as non-essential, he'll be eligible for the draft unless deferred for reasons of age or health. The Work or Fight program is the administration's final attempt to solve the manpower problem by means of persuasion. If it doesn't produce results, the president's expected to ask Congress for a labor draft law. As for the gasoline problem, the latest report is that A rations in the East are to be increased to exactly 2 gallons a week. OPA will make an announcement on the subject sometime tonight. I return you now to New York.
Bill Downs, Columbia's correspondent in Moscow, reports by cable that the German high command ordered counterattacks on 3 active Russian fronts today, but front dispatches say they all failed. The German position at Kharkov appears hopeless. Fighting continues in the swamps around Karachev on the Bryansk front, and the Russians report a steady advance in their new offensive from Spas-Demensk. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from our sponsor.
In 20 years, radio has become a necessity in every American home. But it's even more of a necessity on the field of battle. Radio has probably played an important part in every battle action which has been described in this Admiral broadcast. Today, both great Admiral plants are working at full speed, churning out many kinds of radio equipment to help meet the requirements of our fighting men. The need for radios on the home front, therefore, can be met only by taking proper care of all home sets now in operation. Treat your radio as the precious, irreplaceable instrument it is. When service is wanted, call your Admiral dealer. With full assurance, he is doing everything in his power to keep all radios, regardless of make, operating at peak efficiency. After the war, Admiral will resume production as the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. We'll adapt the wartime advances of science and industry to the peacetime production of America's smart set.
Attention, men and women of Chicago. Your country needs you. Help build vital communication equipment for our frontline fighters at the great Admiral plants in Chicago. The work is easy and interesting. No experience is necessary, and you'll be paid while learning. The factories are modern with the latest type machinery as well as company cafeterias for your convenience. Simply go to the employment office of the Admiral plant at 4150 North Knox Avenue by taking a Montrose streetcar to 4600 West. Or take the Armitage Avenue car to the Admiral plant at 3815 Armitage. Get into radio now, the modern business with a great future. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Continental Radio and Television Corporation brings you World News Today, direct from the leading news centers of the world. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.